Hey everybody, on this episode of 10,000 Feet, Aaron Shaver of OST interviews Dr. Scott Brasser, an internal medicine physician at Spectrum Health. This episode is the second in our MedTech series where we talk with healthcare professionals to learn how technology impacts their working life. Enjoy.
So you went to med school in the Caribbean?
Sure, yeah.
Tell me about that. That must have been pretty great.
It was very good.
Okay.
It actually is an interesting way to that I ended up there. First of all, back in the 80s, going to a foreign medical school was not really all that much of a problem. Whether you went to University of Michigan or Michigan State or whether you went to Ireland or Mexico, it really didn't make a bit of difference. And so nobody wasn't going to tell me that I was not going to be a doctor. You know, I knew this when I was 5 years old. And
okay.
When they asked me if I wanted to be a fireman or a policeman or Superman or a doctor, it was always a doctor. Mm-hmm. And so I went through undergraduate and I applied to medical school and I got put on three alternate lists, mm-hmm. three waiting lists.
Okay.
And well, they never called. And as a med tech, I could do a one-year internship, and that was by design. Mm-hmm. And so I did my internship, and then I applied, and I got put on a couple more alternate lists. So
okay.
I was right there. I was right at the cusp. And I said, screw it, at the time. And so I applied to some of the foreign medical schools and got into all of them, basically,
mm-hmm.
from Ireland and
the Caribbean. Sounds way better.
Oh, it does sound way better.
So how long have you worked in Hastings?
So I moved to Hastings July 4th weekend of 1991.
Okay.
So I'm somewhere between 25 and 30 years.
Okay.
I keep on telling people 30 years, but
so
I think I'll be able to
you've
say
seen
that
a lot of years. Changes in the relationship between independent providers.
Oh, sure.
And health systems.
Oh, sure.
You did rounds in the hospital.
Oh, sure. There wasn't a single employed.
From paper to EMRs.
Oh, yeah.
To
all of it. I lived through all of it.
Yeah.
There wasn't a single.
And you still have a lot of hair.
I do.
Yeah. So you got pretty involved in implementing an EHR in your own practice and then larger ambulatory space in with Spectrum and PennAC.
Yeah. So I set up my own IT system and server and dummy terminals and things like this in my own practice. And then I helped PennAC. I was I'm not sure what they called me, the physician leader or something.
Physician
crazy.
Champion.
Something like that.
You got to add the champion.
Yeah, something like that.
It's important.
That set up Meditech in the hospital for the very first time. And and like any system that's set up, there's always a rough out-of-the-block start. And I guess the thing that I'm proud of most is that the team that we were working with, once we went live, mm-hmm. it was very rough for the first 2, 3, 4 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And there was lots of things to fix and lots of things to change right away. But we never had to shut down and start over. Once we went live, we stayed live. And it slowed a little bit. There were problems, but we fixed them on the run. And Meditech took off. And then, mm-hmm. of course, they changed over to one of the other systems. I can't remember off the top of my head.
You had eClinical.
Yeah,
Works,
that's right.
They
went
somewhere.
From Meditech to eClinical. And
eClinical Works to Epic.
And then to Epic, right.
Yeah. So you've seen a few different.
And then I seen Epic was the one that I set up in my office.
Mm-hmm.
I had a dual server system.
Yeah, you became like a quasi IT guy there for a while.
I was, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I hold myself out as one of the very, very few physicians that that proudly say that, you know, I know IT until, of course, I run across someone like you and then I feel like like a dork when it comes to
IT.
I
don't know. Yeah. I think maybe we're all dorks here. So tell me a little bit about what inspired you to become a physician? If you knew so early on.
Yeah, I did.
Was there a life event?
Yep.
Was there?
Yeah,
okay,
absolutely.
Tell me about that.
It was in one of the state parks in the state of Michigan. That's what we did for family vacations every summer, is that dad and mom took us to state parks.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a 16-foot trailer.
Okay.
And we hauled it around and we went from state park to state park every summer. And, you set up camp and then there's other kids and other campgrounds and other neighbors and stuff. And so we ended up getting to know our neighbors at the campground. And then we would you know, the kids were there and we would play together and we'd go out to the beach together. And one afternoon we all decided to go to the beach, and their mom said, well, I think I might head back to the campground and mm-hmm. and clean up a little bit. So the kids stayed at the beach and my dad stayed at the beach. And my mom and this other lady started heading back to camp. Mm-hmm. And just a few minutes later, my mom started running back to us and saying, Bob, my dad. Mm-hmm. And Bob, you know, come quick. You know, Mrs. So-and-so is, you know, passed out. Mm-hmm. And so she was walking halfway back. And whether she had a heart attack or a stroke or, mm-hmm. you know, whatnot, she just passed out. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, all the kids went running and we went running. And it was probably in the early 70s, late 60s, probably the late 60s. And nobody really did anything. I mean, nobody really knew CPR. Nobody really knew first aid. Nobody really knew anything. Mm-hmm. My dad was a pharmacist, so he knew a little bit of first aid. And he was one of the early ones to take on learning CPR, whatever that was at the time. Mm-hmm. And he volunteered on the ambulance a little bit because he was a pharmacist and he knew a little bit. So he thought, well, I'll just help out.
Yeah.
And so he tried his hand at CPR for the very first time. And we, and of course, I was watching it, taking it all in.
Wow.
And a good half hour, 45 minutes later, Dad's still doing CPR, as effective or ineffective as it was. Mm-hmm. And the ambulance showed up, which was a bunch of volunteer guys.
Yep.
And they basically had the attitude that, well, you know, she's gone. And the kids started crying. Everybody started crying. And they said, well, all right, let's load her up. And, you know, I know now that they probably quit CPR a mile down the road. But and I never heard or found out whatever happened to her. But I'm sure she died. Mm-hmm. And I just took that all in. And I said,
you know, felt kind of helpless as a kid. And just
helpless.
Like, I don't want to be helpless like
this. You know
what?
I told myself right then and there that would never happen again. Not mm-hmm. that somebody wouldn't die ever again.
But it wouldn't be because you weren't prepared for it.
It wouldn't be because I wasn't going to try something. I don't care if it was putting a Band-Aid on their toe. Mm-hmm. I was going to do something to stay in there.
Yeah.
And so I went back and I, you know, had my mom go through the first aid kit, show me how to use it. And then I, you know, learned first aid. And then I was in Cub Scouts and Boy Scouts and got the first aid merit badges.
You've been doing this right along.
Oh, all the way along. And then I just never quit. And then I became an EMT. And then I volunteered on the ambulance. And then I, you know, went into some paramedic classes. And then I did pre-med in college and applied to medical school.
This is like a whole continuum. It's not like you just became a doctor one day. This is who you are.
Nope. Me, where I'm at today is because of what happened to me when I was 5 years old. Hmm.
So let's talk about, so we fast forward.
Sure.
We're here today. You've been through a lot of transition. You described quite a journey there just from the time you were a little guy having this experience. How are we doing caring for patients? You've seen this change in provider-patient relationship from the, you're my patient, I know your family, I know your parents, I know I went to your graduation, whatever it is, to the mergers and acquisitions of healthcare, the digital journey of the abstraction of the patient record. How has that changed your perspective on how we're doing caring for patients?
Yeah, it's interesting how you say how we're doing, and everything that you listed there was everything outside of what doctors do.
Yeah.
I mean, basically everything that you mentioned and you said, how are we doing? I know what you're referring to. You're talking about the acquisitions and the hospitals and and the IT and the paper.
Has it made us better or worse?
You know, I don't think it's changed.
It's the same.
It's exact, because see, what healthcare is what happens inside the exam room between a physician and a patient.
Yeah.
Now, whether that has to be in an exam room or whether it can be over the internet or whether it can be over a screen of some sort or a telephone call, that is likely to change. But it basically boils down to what the patient says to the doctor and what the doctor says to the patient. And for the most part, that really hasn't changed. I mean, through a lot of the things that I've been through, I've got to a point where I've just said, look, you know, I'm going to come in, I want a cup of coffee, let me see my patients, I'll write my notes, and then I'm going to go home.
I'm going to go home.
Now, cool. There's nothing in there about acquisition or...
But being on the other side of it, right? I've been in corporate healthcare and technology for my whole career. Like, we've put a lot of effort into this.
It's sure.
A little bit of an indictment, right?
Sure.
And I'm okay with that. That we've gone to all this expense, all this effort.
Right.
But we haven't really made a difference for you or patients.
No, I don't think so. I mean, it basically, it, Well, it basically boils down to this day, even this morning when I was at work, it boils down to me seeing patients in the exam room and me writing the note to document that visit somehow and going home. And whether you put a paper chart in front of me or whether you put
an
IT computer in front of me or whether you put a video screen in front of me, it basically boils down to that. As a matter of fact, when I first picked up the nurse that I have now, she says, well, how do you want me to do this? And how do you want me to do that? And what do you want me to do when this happens? And we went through this whole thing. Basically, the thing I had her walk away with is, if I'm not in the room talking to the patient, something's wrong. Mm-hmm. Now, I get how you have to take a blood pressure and you have to take a pulse and you have to, I get how you have to do that. But beyond that, if I'm not in the room, we're wasting time. Mm-hmm. And that's where one of my gripes is with the current system, is that with IT, you could put so much information to a computer. I think people are trying to put everything into the computer. They want your depression history. They want your family history. They want all your vaccinations. They want everything, and they want everything scored. Mm-hmm. And they track all these scores. They track all the, if you have high blood pressure, they want to know if I've repeated that blood pressure. And of course, unless I documented, I didn't do it, apparently. And they track how often I repeat the blood pressure if it's elevated. Those are the numbers that they're looking at. They don't, tongue in cheek, they don't really care whether I actually take care of the blood pressure or not. Mm-hmm. They just simply want it documented that I noticed that it was elevated and that I repeated the blood pressure and I documented the second reading.
Yeah.
And it sucks because that's not patient care. That's just documenting patient-physician interaction. Mm-hmm. And so when people like the Joint Commission come along or when other groups come along that pay for health care, they say, well, we're not going to give you any money unless we're sure that you have a quality healthcare system.
Yeah.
Well, what can we show them? We can't show them patient-physician interaction. Mm-hmm. All they can show them is documentation. Mm-hmm. And so it seems like what a lot of this IT stuff has done is driven the documentation of the interaction as the more important thing. Now they're hoping that you're going to take care of the patient, and that's reflected in patient satisfaction scores.
To a degree,
know? Yeah. But, they're chasing the documentation.
So do you think that there's a day, so you talked about collecting a lot of data.
Yeah.
Collecting data is vastly different than delivering insights.
Sure.
Right? Now, there is theoretically, we've seen it in other industries, the benefit to being able to harvest insights from large data sets at scale.
Sure.
Do you think there's any clinical value, not just in research, not just in a dark room for administration, but at the point of care with a provider to say, hey, you have this unique situation. We've looked at the data set. Here's the situation that's happened 100 times over in the US and where other doctors did. Do you see a day that comes where we're able to derive point of care clinical insights from?
Sure. And I think we do that a little bit. It's just now catching on, at least at the ground level. But that's, there's a term for it. I can't remember off the top of my head right now. But Up to Date is a publication that comes out. Mm-hmm. And positive outcomes or outcome-based medicine, I think, is a term I was looking for.
Sure.
You know, outcome-based medicine. So I know a number of physicians that will say, gee, you know, I want to treat seizures, and I would normally use Dilantin for it. Mm-hmm. And they go, they instantly doubt their own knowledge base, mm-hmm. and they go right to some type of
a database
yeah. that says, you know, outcome-based medicine or outcome-based practice. And they look up the word seizure and they see that, oh, Tegretol is now the one that seems to work just a hair better than Dilantin, and they'll order Tegretol, you know, which I guess there's nothing wrong with. And so that, I think, addresses what you were alluding to.
A little bit.
Like, at what point does point of care become affected by data collection? Mm-hmm. I guess that would be it. But I still rely 99.9% of my treatments based on my own experience, my own knowledge. Of course, I got 30 years behind me now.
But, yeah, not everybody's got that depth of experience, right?
And I work with a few of them too, and they're always asking questions, which is wonderful. But they can always search out the same answer on something like Up to Date or something like this, which is apparently always changing.
Yeah, yeah. All right, well, let's talk a little bit. So you've talked a little bit about what you've disliked about it, what you like about it, how it's impacted clinical care. Let's switch to a little bit more personal subject. So tell us a little bit about an experience that you've had in healthcare that impacted a family member. You talked a little bit about as a kid.
So I think you're alluding to the my life-changing event recently, and that is December of 2014, I was on my way to work. I always like to say minding my own business.
Yeah, you never do that. I know better.
Which all my friends that listen to this are going, wait a second, that's not him. And I had this excruciating pain, and people that say that they've been through childbirth, or people say that they've had a kidney stone, you know, talk about this excruciating pain. And although I've had kidney stones, this was like a factor of, you know, 200 higher than a kidney
stone.
This is
the 10 out of 10
This
pain.
Is like 15 out of 10.
15 out of 10.
This is the 10 out of 10 because nobody could imagine that there's anything higher than
a 10. You didn't
know.
Yeah, okay.
But nobody knows that there's more than a 10.
It's inconceivable.
Yeah. It was easily higher than a 10, and it took my breath away. I became dizzy, and I, you know, the first thing I thought of is that I was having a heart attack. Mm-hmm. Of course, my clinical mind kicked in, and I started going through the.
You start diagnosing.
I
yourself?
Started diagnosing myself. I started going through. I said, "Well, wait a second. I'm not sweaty. I'm not this. I'm not that." Mm-hmm. And so I don't think it's a heart attack. And then I thought, oh, you know, I felt like something was ripping. And so then I thought, okay, well, it's an esophageal varice. And I thought, well, wait a second, it can't be an esophageal varice. I'm not bleeding, mm-hmm. you know, so that's not it. I'm not choking, so that's not it. And then I just thought, oh my gosh, I says, I bet you I'm dissecting my aorta. Mm. And of which my very next thought, quite honestly, was then I'm dead. You know, mm-hmm. I'm easily dead. And I recall my very next thought after that was that, well, I'm driving a car and it's early in the morning. And mm-hmm. if I pass out and die, I'm going to go through someone's front room. Mm-hmm. So I thought, literally, I better pull over so I don't hurt anybody else.
Yeah.
And
this probably all happened in a split second.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. This all happened within, you know, two turns of the wheel.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Going down the road at 25 miles an hour. Surprisingly, in retrospect, I wasn't scared. I knew I was going to die. I recall thinking to myself, this is it. There was no ifs, ands, or buts about it. I knew I was gone. But there wasn't a panic like, oh my gosh, I'm going to die. It was just, hey, this is my time.
Here it is.
And it was, there was no panic. There was no anxiety. There was no frustration. There was no, oh, I should have. Mm-hmm. It was just, hey.
So I got to ask the question that I'm sure everybody wants to know.
Sure.
You just said that you felt your aorta dissect. You could feel it.
Yeah. It was a very ripping sensation. So I pulled over preparing to just pass out. Mm-hmm. And then a good few seconds after that, I didn't pass out. And the dizziness kind of went away a little bit. And at that point, clearly the dissection had stopped. Mm-hmm. And so the pain stopped. Of course, all the damage was done at that point, needless to say. And I didn't really know how much time I had left. Mm-hmm. But I thought, well, am I going to stay here? I could actually literally visually see the hospital from where I was parked. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, well, if it's going to ease up a little bit, I'm going to drive to the hospital. Mm-hmm. And that's when things started getting weird, because I went to the hospital knowing that I probably dissected my aorta, mm-hmm. and I walked up to my office.
What?
I walked.
Which is up, like on the third floor.
Which is on the third floor.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I was dizzy, mm-hmm. and I thought to myself, well, I better hurry up and get to my office so I could sit down. Mm-hmm. You know, but at the same time, another part of me was saying, well, you're going to die. I thought, well, I can't die in the hallway. I mean, someone will
make it to your office,
trip over me. You think weird thoughts, I guess.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And so the first thing I did was called my personal physician, who I knew was more than likely driving in at the moment, because mm-hmm. it was about 6 a.m. or mm-hmm. so. And so I called him. I said, hey, look, I really feel awful. I says, I need to see you in the office today. And he said, where are you at? I said, well, I'm in the office. And he goes, okay. He says, I'll be right there. Don't move. Mm-hmm. And of course, the story that he tells now is that, you know, I never miss work and I never mm-hmm. ask for help and I mm-hmm. never make a doctor's appointment, you know. Mm-hmm. And here I've got this guy calling me who is at the moment the political director of the intensive care unit, mm-hmm. and probably the chief of medicine, you know, asking me for help.
Are you going to give the guy a shout out on your podcast?
Oh, it's Dr. Smendig.
There you okay. Doug Smendig. All right.
He's an amazing doctor.
Isn't he? Indeed. Yeah.
As long as he keeps referring to me as his go-to guy for answers, he's an amazing doctor.
Okay.
Our last visit, he was talking to me about the perils of high blood pressure. And mm-hmm. he goes, you know, this is awfully awkward talking to an internist about the perils of high blood pressure.
Yes.
So, but nonetheless, so he says, stay right there. And so I did. And He comes on in, and of course the door is locked, and he had to find maintenance and get the maintenance in, and he finally finds me. So somehow I made it down to the intensive or to the ER, and Dr. Amy Paholsky, another shout out, was down there.
Yeah,
and they heard what I had to say, and they got a quick EKG, which was perfectly normal, and then they got a CT scan. The CT scan apparently showed the dissection, and the dissection went from my aortic valve all the way down to my legs. And
but that in inches to us non-clinical people.
So that's the whole length of my body. It went from it went from my heart to my groin.
Wow. Okay.
You know, so it went from the aortic valve, which was the inside of the heart, and it ripped all the way down around the arch, all the way down past my diaphragm, past my kidneys, all the way into my legs. It dissected some of the kidney arteries and some of the splenics, which are the blood vessels that supply the intestines. And so they're all split open. And, you know, for the most part, I was... You know, it was just a matter of time before I had died.
Yeah.
And it really was.
Yeah.
And so Amy told me about the dissection, and she says, look, you know, we're going to get you off to Grand Rapids, and we're going to get you on a helicopter because it's just that urgent. And I knew it was. But then the weather was too bad to fly. So they threw me in the back of an ambulance.
And you know about that too, because you're a pilot as
I'm a pilot. All right. And so they threw me in the back of an ambulance, and we went red light and siren all the way up to Grand Rapids. And I was in the emergency room there, and they were ready for me. They had multiple doctors, multiple nurses, a couple of surgeons all ready to go.
Were you conscious at this
point? I was, yeah. Absolutely packed room. You know, later on, a number of them confided in me, saying, you know, they knew I was dead, but I wasn't dead yet. So let's move him up to Grand Rapids. Well, once I got to Grand Rapids, it was like, okay, well, he's going to die, but let's make the effort to at least take him to the operating room.
Yeah.
And once I got to the operating room, it's like, okay, well, he's going to die on the table, but we better at least try to get started. Well, that just kept going.
Nobody wanted to stop.
Nobody wanted to stop, but they all knew that I was going to die during their procedure.
Yep.
And it just never happened. And I ended up going back into surgery for cardiac tamponade, which is fluid around the heart, because it was still bleeding. And again, it had just about stopped. And then they had to go back in surgically and drain the sac around my heart. And apparently I was defibrillated a couple of times, and of course I was unconscious during all that, but and I woke up, and the next thing I remember was my family at the foot of my bed, and they were all smiling, they were all exuberantly happy, and to me it was just like, look, I feel awful, just what are you guys so happy about?
That's everybody smiling about.
And because I just woke up, and as far as I was concerned, it was the next morning. And I find out later that it was a month later, or it was 2-3 weeks later. And so then I started learning the backstory of what happened, and so I think my attitude has changed. I mean, before I was invincible, and I was in charge, I was the director, I was the chief, I was the one, I was the go-to person, and prided myself on, you know, constantly studying so I could help other people, and it just all became unimportant after that.
Has healthcare become more personal for you after
Absolutely. Oh, before it was just, before it was tasks, before it was consults. Other doctors would consult the internist doctors, whether it be myself or one of the other partners, and to help them with their task. And they were just basically a series of tasks to solve, a series of problems.
You see the
solve.
People more now?
Oh, that's nothing but I see. As a matter of fact, one of my patients a while back asked me, you know, if and when I was going to retire. And I told him I was already retired. I'm retired right now. And what that basically means to me is that, you know, I'm no longer that doctor that comes in and solves problems and tasks and medical disease. I basically come in, have my coffee, and I visit with about 15 friends. And, hey, check this out. I went to medical school. So if you want to throw a medical question at me, you know, I'll take a swing at it.
So so life perspective, better before or after?
Oh, it's it's emotionally much better now. But I was built for the life before.
Gotcha.
You know, I loved it. I would easily I don't want to say I'll easily go back into intensive care, but I miss intensive care. I miss the hospital patient. I miss coming in and having nobody know me, and people look at me like, oh my gosh, you know, this is the guy that they've been talking about, or this is the guy that's going to help us in the intensive care unit, and maybe put someone on a ventilator and get them through something that they weren't expected to get through. And that is a wonderful feeling. It's very addictive. But, you know, after, after my heart blew up, you know, I've sort of taken the back seat, but, I truly see people as people, and they've got a lot of other problems other than the medical problem that they're bringing me. And I try to dig those out of them as I try to, walk through their problem with them.
Okay. So I appreciate you sharing that. That's a very personal story. I'm going to ask you a couple like rapid fire questions here.
Yes, no
Don't have to, you can give us a little color. Okay. Huh? Let's talk about technology.
Okay.
Given that perspective.
Yeah.
If you could, you had a magic wand. I don't even care how you solve the problem. We don't have to worry about how the technology works.
Sure.
But if you could solve a problem in healthcare today, what would it be?
In healthcare?
Yeah.
I tell you what's one of the more frustrating things that I deal with in healthcare, but it's at home right now as well too, and that is the interaction between hardware and software. It's very frustrating when I go to print something and the printer's not hooked up or not working right, or I go to click on a button that takes me to another screen and it just sits there and looks at me and nothing happens. Or I am behind on in my day. I'm got busy with somebody, so I'm behind, and I've got to write a bunch of prescriptions. And then the patient says, "Oh, I've got one more thing. Could you order this for me?"
Yeah.
I'm thinking, okay, sure, fine. I'll be glad to do that. So I click a button to go back to the order page, and it just stares at me for a while.
So you don't like technology that stares at you?
Oh, geez, oh, Pete's. I mean, I wish. You know what? I wish I had. I wish I had a magic wand that gave me. Five times the megahertz clock speed that I currently have.
Okay.
Plus five times more chips and maybe a terabyte.
Just make it faster.
A terabyte of RAM on every
computer.
Well,
now you are getting into the technology.
Yeah, but that's what I want.
You want it to go fast.
I just want what I want, when I want, how I want it.
Oh, like okay.
If I want to know your med list, I want it now.
Right now.
And when I want to go to the order page, I want to be at the order page. When I want to know your family history, I want to be at the family history page.
All right, next question. If you could, you have a platform here, a lot of technology people listen to it.
Sure.
As a clinician, what message do you want to send to technology professionals? What would you tell them?
Docs are interested in their patient.
Okay.
Docs are not interested in fancy computer screens and things like this. They need to use that in order to access information to help their patient. But whether it's a computer screen or whether it's a touch screen or whether it's a mouse or whatever else, just remember that the doc is worrying about their patient. And technology typically slows us down, whether it's because something's not working right or something needs to be rebooted. And this is the craziest thing, why I thought of this, I don't really know, but imagine like these updates are horrendous. Granted, software needs to be updated, but imagine being in a car going down a highway and you stop and get something to eat at McDonald's, and you get back to your car and the headlight button's been moved.
Or it's like, sorry, you can't drive it right now. It's updating.
It's updating. Yeah. Or imagine the blinkers being in the wrong spot. Or imagine it going from a manual or an automatic transmission to a manual transmission. Or imagine the whole interior being a different color.
Okay.
Or something like this. Or the speedometer, the speed limit thing going from an analog to a digital or back to an analog
again.
Or
it's miles and it was kilometers
or something.
Whatever,
And not that you can't get used to it. And not that they haven't proven that the way they changed it.
But you lose the muscle memory you had.
Oh, you know what? Yeah. I was going to bring that up. The muscle memory. You lose it.
And your efficiency goes down.
And your efficiency goes down. And then you end up saying to yourself, okay, well, I need to write this new prescription. You know, where's the order page again? The order page used to be right here. Now it's not there anymore.
Yeah.
So you spend 2 or 3 minutes looking for it.
Okay, so less is more.
Oh,
that's what you're saying.
Less is more.
Less is more. Okay.
I wish dealing with a computer screen, there were certain basic things that regardless of the update, always stayed the same in the same spot.
So this brings an analogy to my mind. You're a pilot. I'm a pilot.
Sure.
I don't know, was it the mid-60s, mid-70s? They developed the standard configuration pilots for six-pack gauges.
Sure.
Right?
I know exactly what you're talking about.
And when you're an instrument pilot, you learn your instrument scan.
Right. Muscle memory of your eyeball.
Muscle memory of your eyes. You do this instrument scan, and to those who aren't pilots, if you don't have a good instrument scan, you're dead.
Right. Now move those instruments.
Prior to this standardization, and I think it was the mid-60s maybe, right. late 60s.
Right.
They could have any configuration anywhere, and you have to look all over the place.
Right.
Standardizing the configuration saved a lot of lives.
Right.
Do you think of it as that? Yes. Like, can we not have a standard instrument?
Perfect. That's absolutely perfect. That maybe if I had one computer software company and you had a different computer software company, that's fine.
My problem. Yeah.
But the standard layout is going to be the same.
Huh. Imagine that.
So.
So your scan, where you find things.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
So like right now, as I think of the software that I use right now. I have to stop and think, okay, what do I want? And then where did they put that? Mm-hmm. And I have to think to myself, where'd they put that? Or where is it likely to be? Now, of course, if it's something simple like I want to know what medicine they're on, I can go to their medicine page. And, mm-hmm. But oftentimes getting to their medicine page is still a couple clicks away and maybe a scan. Mm-hmm. You know, you're on the right page, but you don't see it. You have to scan to it.
Yeah.
You know, you have to scroll to it, maybe, I guess, would be the right word. And that's frustrating. So if we had like a...
We need the six pack of information that you can scan.
We do. We need something across the top of the screen.
I think maybe we just came up with an idea there.
We need something across the very top of the screen.
That says
family history, social history, medications, allergies, or you can combine them like meds and allergies together, family history, social history together, past medical history, past surgical history together. Yeah, you can combine
somehow them, standardize it.
But put them up at the very top. So if at the moment's notice, if you're talking and you say something like, every time I get short of breath, my hands all cramp up, you know?
Sure.
And
so it's right there.
Yeah, so I go up to family history and I just click it, and instantly I'm at family history. I can look back to see what's listed there, and then I can click on something else and go to something else. But you know, there needs to be some upgrades, definitely. But upgrade the inside pages. Don't upgrade the standard six pack.
Yeah, the six pack.
The six pack of medicine.
I like that. The six pack of medicine. Okay, good idea. All right, I'm gonna end with one question here.
Okay.
Personal recommendation to our listeners. Could be a place to travel, a book to read, a food to eat, a workout routine, meditation, whatever. Recommend something to our podcast listeners that they can take away and try for themselves that you've found meaningful.
And this is coming from the bottom of my heart. Everyone needs to try a random act of kindness.
Okay.
A random act of kindness. It has to be done in a way where you actually pursue it. You actually look for it. You actually scan the public around you. You actually scan the people in the grocery store. You actually scan the people that are around you, and you look for people that need help.
Yeah.
And you deliberately reach out to them, and you deliberately do something that there's no way that they could ever repay you. And that could be very, very small. It doesn't need to be expensive. It doesn't need to be money. It doesn't need to be anything. Now, it might be money, but it doesn't need to be. You get addicted to that.
Yeah.
You absolutely get addicted to that. And then, of course, a corollary to that is, you know, is to set up some type of pay it forward system.
Good.
You know, either do something, and when someone just insists on paying you back, or here, let me give you that. No, I don't
just
want
don't.
It. Just, hey, look, it's
no
a gift.
Strings attached.
Don't make this difficult. It's a gift. Pay it forward. If you need to, if your heart needs to pay me off, pay it forward.
Yeah.
So random act of kindness. All right. You got to get addicted to that.
What an appropriate message for the holiday season.
There you go. Well, so, it's not. And so many people think about that along the holiday season, but it's fun to do it in the middle of March too.
Absolutely. All right. Well, Dr. Scott Brosser, thanks for being on with us.
Wonderful. Thanks
time.
For having me.
Yeah, absolutely.
Great.
OST, changing how the world connects together. For more information, go to ostusa.com/podcast.